You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
In last year's Public Perception of Corruption Index, compiled by Transparency International, New Zealand tied for first place with Denmark. However, just a month before the index was released, New Zealand's largest bribery trial came to a close, with co-defendants Murray Noon and Stephen Borlase both found guilty. Herald reporter Matt Nippert covered the case. I asked him what the nature of Noon and Borlase's relationship was.
They'd known each other for some time, I think. The court heard it was in the early 90s. Noon had worked for Borlase as a consultant, and this relationship continued through when Noon was employed full-time, first at the Royal Edinburgh Council, then Auckland Transport. It was put to the court by Mr. Borlase that, you know, he was a very generous, gregarious person who liked mixing business and pleasure, and he considered Noon to be a personal friend.
And I understand a lot of the money that was transferred was for consultancy work?
Yeah, well, this was sort of at the heart of the Grant case. A lot of the headlines, most of the ones I wrote actually, concerned sort of ridiculously lavish lunches and overseas trips and stuff people can relate to and things. But really at the heart of it was a series of payments from Borlase to Noon, pretty much clockwork every month between $8,000 and $10,000. And these were invoices recorded as consultancy work. The defence to all this was, all this money, it was about just touch over $1 million all up over the period, was indeed paid because Noon was doing work for Borlase. However, the judge wasn't particularly impressed by the fact there was no documentary evidence at all of any of this actual work being done. And indeed, no one seemed to know outside of Borlase and Noon what he did. So Judge Fitzgerald said that was just simply not credible and ran with the prosecution's line that indeed this money was just to influence him in his role awarding writing contracts.
So it wouldn't have been illegal if he'd actually been doing work for Borlase, but surely isn't that still a conflict of interest?
I don't know, it's huge. I mean, he, remember, while Noon just got sent to jail last week, he lost his job 3 years ago. And I think we did some more work. A grand total of 8 staff at Auckland Council either quit or were fired as a result of this. Yes, it was conceded that, yes, Noon should have declared all this stuff. I mean, council thought they had the policies in place to deal with this. You know, if you get a gift of more than, I think, $100, you're supposed to report it to your manager and it's recorded in the gift register. You weren't supposed to take substantial things for free. He just took them all and didn't declare it. And there's one thing that's criminal corruption, that's a very high bar to prove. It was proven in this case. But the next step down, the sort of conflict of interest of an employment matter, there's much more of that around, I expect.
And what sort of money was Progens making through this relationship?
Well, it wasn't... The prosecution case wasn't as though it was Noon would get paid $10,000 and approve $1 million contract. It wasn't quite as straightforward as that. It was this ongoing relationship. But to put things into perspective, when Noon first started working with Ronnie District Council and receiving these consultancy payments in 2007, Progens, you know, had less than $1 million in revenue from councils and was barely breaking even. By the time it was all discovered in 2012, Progens was making around $4 million profit a year, sort of contracts, I think, more than $10 million a year. So it had grown quite rapidly and it became extraordinarily profitable, it appears, on the back of this relationship.
During the trial, the Crown alleged that this all happened within a context of a culture of collaboration at Auckland Transport and the council with private contractors.
Well, the culture of collaboration was actually a line brought up by the defence, saying the fact they hung out a lot with staff and paid for their transport to accommodations and they had, you know, repeated long lunches. The council was encouraging this sort of public-private partnership, so to speak. The Crown had gone further and said it was the Auckland Roading version had a culture of corruption that's effectively everyone knew Noon was on the take, or at least it was accepted that you're allowed to take free stuff from contractors. And no one declared anything, and hence, you know, why you end up with 8 people losing their jobs and 2 of them charged. The judge, however, didn't quite agree with that cultural line. There was a line in her judgment, I think what's referred to in the legal profession as a comfort note, effectively saying her findings relate just to the road maintenance division, not to the rest of council. You know, although this case has sort of ripped a scab off quite an ugly wound, and I think there might need to be more work undertaken to see exactly how far this goes.
Do you think that this case is over, or will there be more?
I think there's more stuff around the fringes. Certainly the big ticket item, that $1 million in cash payments from Noon to Borlase, is fairly unprecedented in New Zealand public service, and I think the SFO are right to focus on that in their prosecution. But there's this subsidiary, it's a grey tier, that the Serious Fraud Office Director says you know, there are a lot of people in that office they could have charged but didn't. They sort of just picked the two Auckland transport staffers who received the most. And I think there's probably, not just at Auckland Council, but more broadly in New Zealand, I think it would be worthwhile for organisations to have a close look at both their policies in this area and also whether they're being enforced. Because if anything, this case has shown is that you have the best policies in the world, but if you've got a culture where people don't really care about them, they mean nothing.
Just finally, New Zealand always scores quite well in the Corruption Perception Index. Should we have such confidence?
Well, remember that that ranking is a relative thing. So New Zealand is less corrupt than other countries. I mean, you just need to look across the ditch to Australia to see some quite extraordinary corruption cases coming in there, half of them involving the police, half of them involving sort of state-level politicians, and involving enormous sums of money. So I know New Zealand was getting kicked around a bit by the OECD. They have an anti-bribery task force because we simply weren't prosecuting these cases. They weren't being picked up. It's hard to tell whether we deserve it or not because so much of the stuff happens under the surface. I'd like to think we do, but certainly that shouldn't stop us rooting this out where we see it because, you know, once it takes root, you're in real trouble.
Although Borlase was sentenced to 5.5 years in prison, the status of the money made through his actions is unclear. Of the four companies which made up the ProGens Group, three have been liquidated, with the survivor, ProGens Holdings, filing its most recent annual return in September 2016. Will the ProGens millions ever be recovered, or have they already been lost to a shadowy world of family trusts and holding companies? New Zealand's place in this world was detailed in the Panama Papers, leaked documents from law firm Mossack Fonseca. Around 80 journalists from around the globe worked to convert more than 10 million legal documents into an understandable format. One of them was New Zealand's own Nicky Hager. I asked him just how the process of hiding money from the authorities worked.
What happens is that somebody in Russia or in the United States or in Lithuania or somewhere wants to put their money where no one will ever find it, where their wife will never find it, or the people who they've ripped off will never find it, or whatever it is. And so they set up technically legal entities in other countries. So they might have a trust set up in New Zealand, the Happy Money Trust of New Zealand, which never has to be reported and doesn't appear on any public list. In other words, no one apart from their lawyer even knows it's been opened. And then that trust might own a company in a different country. It might own a company in South America or something. And so you've got the New Zealand Trust, which no one even knows about, which owns a company in South America, which no one knows about. And then the company in South America opens a bank account in Cyprus, which has only got the name of the company written on it. And so the person can operate a bank account in Cyprus, which is very hard to track down. Millions of dollars can come and go. And if someone's trying to find the money, they don't know who owns that bank account or who owns the company or who owns the trust which owns it, which means that each of those countries, including New Zealand, has helped to set up this impenetrable track which allows people to keep their stuff secret.
And is it impossible to trace all this money?
In some cases, like if you put something through the British Virgin Islands, or if you even put it through the Cook Islands, our near neighbour, which New Zealand has helped to set up as a tax haven, the law there says that nobody is allowed to provide the information, that you break the law if you provide information on the foreign clients. And so it can be set up, so it's very hard to ever track it down. And of course, this is the work of police forces and investigative journalists around the world is trying to track these things down. But it's an unequal fight. It's made too hard by these things because if you start to track them down, they can just close that company and set up another one in a different tax haven. The answer to this is not that you make them more open, really. It is that there needs to be collective action to close down tax havens all around the world. And New Zealand should actually lead the way by being one of the first ones to go. One really good way we could do it was to say, we don't believe that the world should have tax havens. We are a minor tax haven. We are going to lead the way by closing it down. That would be the best thing we could do, and the world would respect us very much if we had the guts to do that.
How does New Zealand serve as a tax haven?
We're not one of the world's main tax havens, but the way we'd serve as a tax haven and attract really dodgy and unpleasant clients from around the world is by providing secrecy. That's what tax havens are about. Tax havens are not about banking services or investment services. They're about secrecy. They're about people being able to put their money somewhere where no one ever knows it's there and no foreign companies or governments or police even ask the question of whether it exists because they can't find it. And up until now, for about the last several decades, New Zealand has provided secret trusts which don't get found out about simply because there's no way to find out about them. There's no public list of them. There's no private list of them. There's no requirement for the government to collect information on them so that they can help foreign police agencies or governments when they try to find out. So we've created one of the black holes around the world where if people want to hide their business, they can hide behind an entity, in this case a trust in New Zealand. Now, having said this, because of the Panama Papers, things have improved a bit. The government initially, when the Panama Papers, when we first came out with the stories, John Key said, there's nothing here, it's ridiculous, New Zealand's got no problem, we're not a tax haven. And then within a few days, he called an inquiry into it because it was obvious that people didn't like what we were revealing. And because of that, there's a law going through Parliament which is going to make it that the authorities at least have to ask the lawyers who set up these things to say who their real clients are and who really put the money into these trusts and where the money really is, which is a step forward. But it's not a step forward far enough, because when a foreign journalist is trying to track down where someone's money turned up, when somebody in another country is looking at their local progens and they're thinking, so they put this money into the such and such trust, which maybe is in New Zealand, there's no way that they'll be able to find out what that is. So while a foreign police force has got more chance if it knows, if it gets tipped off of tracking something to New Zealand, unfortunately the rest of the world, and particularly the media, will still get to a locked door when they get as far as New Zealand.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.